This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, I'm Bill Bunbury, and welcome to Hindsight, and to a special series, It's Not the Money, It's the Land. Today, the first of three programmes about the effects of an historic legal decision handed down from the bench in 1966, nearly 35 years ago. The decision to grant equal wages to Aboriginal pastoral workers on the cattle stations of Northern Australia. Our first programme's called, And In This Land, We Pay the Price.
We grew up in station and we've been ringing in there. And the station manager or the station owner, we got to show them where the cattle run and how to get around. But when the work start, we were going from there and never stop. Droving cattle, mustering and branding. Because we were the sheep labour. Aboriginal people were the sheep labour. And in this land we paid a price. From all that thing, we never even get nothing back.
What I think the tragedy of all was that nobody sat down, nobody thought about what the repercussions was going to be. They just let it happen. And what amazes me always does about this whole thing, we're supposed to be a clever country, we're an enlightened country. We allowed decisions to take place without any thought, consultation with the parties who are involved. And we've got a disaster on our hands. 30 years down the track.
Former pastoralist Peter Murray and former stockman Jackie Dan. So what was the tragedy 30 years down the track? And was it all a disaster? These are questions I've been trying to ask as I put together this three-part Hindsight special on the equal wage decision of 1966. What I found was that the answers aren't simple and that the questions remain. And I should warn Indigenous listeners that from time to time in this series, they may hear the voices of deceased persons. When the Equal Wages case, initiated by the NAWU, the Northern Australian Workers Union, on behalf of Indigenous workers, was heard by the Commonwealth Conciliation and Arbitration Commission, it seemed that only two parties were present. The pastoralists, who put up a strong case against the granting of equal wages, and the NAWU, who argued, on the other hand, that equal wages were a matter of social and economic justice. Aboriginal workers were certainly not in court and not directly cited in evidence by either party. Until the equal wages case of 1965, pay for Aboriginal pastoral workers had been patchy and unregulated. In Queensland, Aboriginal stockmen and drovers were paid almost a full wage. And in the Pilbara, where Aboriginal workers had walked off the stations in 1946, some pay also existed. But in the Northern Territory and in the Kimberley region of northwestern Australia, pay was mostly in kind. Tea, sugar, flour, blankets and clothes as needed. The upside was that the pastoralists kept the entire community, workers, older people and children, all in rations and looked after their medical needs. It was a way of life, as we'll hear shortly, that had gone on for almost a century. When the case came up in 1965, lawyer Hal Wootton was junior counsel to John Kerr as advocate for the pastoralists in their case against the union. But as the case went on, he became concerned about the outcome.
My deepest personal feeling about it was the one that's epitomised in the complete absence of Aborigines' lack of communication. I felt this is fundamentally wrong. This shouldn't be done just on the basis of what unions want. Somebody should ask Aborigines what they want. Somebody should explain to Aborigines the likely consequences. And they should have a say in this, and they should have a choice.
Hal Wootton, and we'll come back to the 1965 equal wages case later. But it's worth asking how things got this way, why Aboriginal people weren't paid properly for their work, and how they became involved with the pastoral industry in the first place. Historian Geoffrey Bolton suggests that in the Kimberley, Aborigines took up pastoralism almost as soon as the first white cattlemen.
Aborigines in the north were very quick to adapt Western technology, and this ranges from being able to ride horses, which they'd never seen before, of course, to the fact that even before they came in, they looked at stockyards. They said, we can build stockyards, and they were using them to impound cattle which they had pinched from the interloping pastoralists.
Where they could capture cattle, they were setting up their own mustering setups.
Well, there's certainly evidence of that. That was reported by police and graziers. They'd find these stockyards that they hadn't built. The Kimberley district in the 1880s is the place where the conquest of Australia is completed. It was only 70 years after the Blue Mountains had been crossed. It was not much more than 50 after Western Australia had been settled. And you have largely sheep pastoralists working their way up the Western Australian coast. You have cattlemen coming from New South Wales and Queensland, reaching across the territory, and in the end, the two pincers meet, and that's the end of the invasion.
What the pastoralists were dealing with, I guess, was a pretty strong, intact culture then when they first encountered Aboriginal people in this country.
Very much so, and we don't know how far the word had spread from Aboriginal group to Aboriginal group about the impact of the white fellas, but by the time the Kimberleys were occupied in the 80s, There always seems to be a slight pause of a year or two before the hostilities commence, and almost always it is that the cattle or the sheep intrude on the traditional hunting grounds, the Aborigines help themselves to beef or mutton, the settlers say this is our property and start to take reprisals, and then the stakes are escalated and it's killing.
The Aboriginals originally found that the white people were spreading out, so they decided, as their normal foods were being destroyed and their normal range where they were, because they saw the pastoralists come in with their cattle and sheep, they decided, oh, well, what the hell, we might as well spear an odd one of these to help ourselves. They're eating all the grass and everything like that, so why shouldn't we? So then big conflicts came when the white settlers said, a lot of them, by the way, could speak the language. My grandfather learnt to speak the Nigana language. And when they were challenged about, oh, you're disturbing all our cattle on such and such a run, or you're disturbing all our sheep and killing them and so on, and you can't do that, and, you know, the only place to go then was onto the station itself where, you know, meals were provided and so on. So it was in the interests of the pastoralists to make this offer to the early tribesmen that, all right, you know, we don't want you spearing our cattle and destroying them and so on. We'll kill a bullock for you every time. I think Patsy Jurek had an arrangement with some of the Aboriginals that he was involved with in the territory and over in the East Kimberley, that they would kill a beast for them. But then that degenerated into virtual slavery, if you like, because the pastoralists were not paying them at all, and they got away with it, I suppose you could say, but it was sort of the accepted norm.
Kim Rose, whose family were pioneer Kimberley pastoralists.
Well, you can't ignore the fact that there was a lot of violence on the frontier, and the area that I know most about is the Northern Territory. There were massacres and the legendary poison waterholes and so on. So there was a bit of a legacy of fear. Aboriginal people that I met in the Northern Territory in the late 70s, early 80s, still knew about those stories, but they also remembered the decision that their communities made to come into the cattle stations. They started to sort of weigh up their situation, and their prospects for survival in this warfare situation were clearly not good. They also started to learn more about the white people, they were white men really, by observing them. And they got to know which ones they might be able to trust a bit to get to a negotiation stage. And so they negotiated their way onto the cattle stations as labour. But I think it's interesting to reflect upon the fact that, you know, Aboriginal and white people negotiated some sort of a compromise situation. Because Aboriginal people didn't want to be pushed off their land. Their land was so important to them and on many different levels. And to work on the cattle stations was a way of being able to look after their country and survive under the new colonial regime.
Historian Anne McGrath. So did the Aboriginal people have any bargaining power in this situation? Anne McGrath again.
Well, I think the white employer just wanted a labour force. And the Aboriginal people basically said, you only get this labour force if you have our community camping on your station. So the white people had no choice about it. For Aboriginal people who worked in the cattle industry, they would be totally insulted if their old people weren't allowed to camp there, if their children, if the women with young babies who may not be the most productive workers were on the station. It was just a condition that they set. Now, it was certainly not a condition the white people would have asked for.
What happened, I think, was that many of the non-Indigenous people who came had to learn about the country, and the only ways they could learn about the country, the season, where the best grasses were, where the best water was, what the best time of the year is to do certain things, and what stock do on these lands, they learnt out of the experience of the Aboriginal people, as well as them becoming good horse people, you know, horsemen and horsewomen. The starting of that life began very early, at 10 or 11 for a young fella or a young girl working in a cattle camp. So they relied on that workforce to build up those herd numbers and to get cattle to the markets. And most of those droving teams in those early years would have been, the majority of them would have been Aboriginal stockmen with a white overseer or a couple of white fellas. Not many of them would have been white stock people.
The old stockmen, the old native stockmen, they were the one that grew the land and grew the station. For pastoralists, managers, owners that owned the station, they should get the regret, because they're the one that, you know, started the station for them and got the cattle industry going, with sale cattle and that in the beginning.
Retired stockman Basil Thomas, and before him Pat Dodson, former chair of the Reconciliation Council, and no stranger to the pastoral life of the Kimberley.
My great-grandfather, who was an Irishman, was described by the Duracs as being more of a black fella than a white fella, because he lived with my great-grandmother, who was an Aboriginal woman from the Gringy side of the country, but they lived around Halls Creek and Springvale Station. So the attitude of equality or of treating Indigenous people with a sense of value and worth as you would treat any other person of your own race didn't seem to be part of the white fella's thinking. Land was there to be taken and to be subordinate, and the people to be indentured or enslaved to achieve the purposes that pastoralists wanted. They weren't there for any other reason. And once you started to run out of the labour force, you'd simply go and grab someone else from another region and bring them to those places and have them enslaved to your direction. And there's specific laws set up to create that, to support the pastoralist position.
From 1898, you have a Department of Aborigines, sometimes combined rather oddly with fisheries, but the real regulation takes place in 1905. There's a Royal Commission set up in 1904 with a character called Dr. William Roth, who's been a protector of Aborigines in Queensland, and not surprisingly, he says you should adopt the Queensland solution. While the Aborigines are at large and unprotected, they'll be exploited, which was half the truth but not the whole truth. You should make them all wards of the state and bring them in under protection. And the pastoralists say, hey, we're employing some of these fellows, we don't want them taken away. So that the state then accepts a token commitment to regulating conditions and trying to avoid the grosser forms of exploitation.
And that means, in effect, then, does it, the system that develops up to 1965, where the pastoralist accepts social and food responsibility, looking after responsibility, but pay is really an ad hoc arrangement?
Pay often doesn't happen at all. The conventional stereotype is they don't know the value of money and they don't need it. And as old MP Durack's alleged to have said, well, of course, and we'll take damn good care they never find out, won't we?
Once people began to settle with a boss who could protect them and who could feed them, who could protect them from the police taking them away, could protect them from, sometimes from their own groups, there was distress, there was disease, there was violence, and it wasn't always only from Europeans. So this paternalistic relationship of protection by the boss and flour, tea, sugar and rationing, work for keep, suited cultural reproduction of Aboriginal people being able to go on into the bush and continue with ceremonies continue to take people out onto country. The opportunity to stay in country with a boss is just as important as the fear and coercion of the circumstances of the frontier. So people establish a relationship on or near their own country and with members of a community, so that wages are not that important.
Historian Mary-Ann Jebb, who has lived in the Kimberley and is now writing about pastoral Aboriginal relationships. World War One must have been a turning point, I guess, in this situation, because that would have affected, I guess, the numbers of people available to work in the pastoral industry. Is that right?
Yeah, it was a major turning point in two or three ways, because a lot of the old experienced white stockmen went off to the war, joined the Light Horse and never came back, or if they did come back, they didn't come back to the north. Plus also, it led the Australian Workers Union to take a keener interest in employment conditions, and they were very strict about the purposes for which Aboriginal staff could be employed. For instance, up until 1916, during the First World War, Emmanuel Brothers, who had the big sheep station at Noonkanbah, they were employing Aboriginal shearers, and for a shearer being a skilled worker, I believe there was some kind of pay arrangement, though I cannot remember what that was. But the union said, no, Barley's on that. You've got to employ white shearers at white shearers' rates. And
this is the old white Australia policy.
It was very much so. And after a few years of that, I think the pressure was such that Emmanuel's decided they'd get out of sheep and they sold Noonkanbah and concentrated on their cattle properties.
Well, in the pre-World War period, pre-World War II in the Northern Territory, they didn't usually receive wages at all. So it was not a cash economy. They were given rations. So they would be given flour. There was sometimes a kitchen where a cook would be giving the main workers meals, three meals a day. Of course, often they're out on a stock camp. There'd be a cook out there giving out food. But the rations were given to be distributed through the whole community. And it was, you know, it was basic stuff. It was flour, sugar, meat, tea, and then they'd be given clothing as well. This, to Western ears, sounds very cruel and unusual, given the period we're looking at, the 1920s and the 30s, where, you know, there were award wages for white workers and so forth. But you've got to remember that on the cattle stations, the white workers weren't using a cash economy either. They'd be paid at the end of the season, and they would take their money and they'd spend it in a town away from the cattle station. So there were stores on these big stations like Victoria River Downs and so forth, but the shop was all credit. So, you know, it was Aboriginal people didn't see money, they didn't see cash, they didn't know anything about it, but then they didn't actually see white people using money either.
Men and women of Australia, Japanese naval and air forces launched an unprovoked attack on British and United States territory. Because our vital interests are imperiled, and because the rights of free people in the whole Pacific are assailed, we are at war with Japan.
Well, I think we've got to look at, I suppose, the war years, really, in Australia. That was the period where Aboriginal people were engaged by the military to do different tasks at the camps, to help clear airstrips, to do menial tasks at the campsites, to help with road construction.
They were paid quite good wages and they were given good uniforms and good living conditions. And once they were exposed to this, they felt, well, you know, all the white blokes should be giving us this. And it was that sense of being on the same standing, the same level as the whites. They saw that as equity, having tasted that. And the other thing was that these soldiers were quite generous to them. So they'd give them luxury products like chocolate and exotic foods and so forth. So they wanted more variety in the Western part of their diet.
So it was the beginnings of a new view of how to interpret the white community, really. And underpinning that picture was the glimpse at equality, the glimpse of being treated as equals.
a respect for the rights of the Aboriginal people to their country, to their language, to their ceremony, to their social way of living. And so going back onto pastoral properties after these things, finding the attitude of a staid group who wanted to subjugate, control and basically render people subservient again was something Indigenous people felt very difficult about.
Their lives were governed by the Welfare Act, and all full-blood Aboriginals were declared as wards of the Director of Welfare, and their lives were totally governed by the Welfare Branch. It involved such issues as marriage. They couldn't marry whom they chose, a whole range of problems. They weren't allowed to drink, they couldn't vote, they couldn't receive their own money. They suffered lots of indignities, and of course the biggest problem that they perceived was the fact that they couldn't get access to commodities because they had no money. The wages that were paid to wards in those days, the maximum that you're allowed to pay an Aboriginal worker was £10. And most Aboriginals were paid something like £3 a week.
Brian Manning, founder member of the Northern Territory Council for Aboriginal Rights. And we'll hear more from him when we get to the 1965 equal wages case itself. But money was still not a big part of station life for most workers. Anne McGrath.
They didn't understand about bookkeeping or about money being deducted out of your salary. And they might work for 6 months and find there was no money. They didn't realise that by taking all these things out of the store, they'd used up their supply of cash out of their wages. And, of course, all their relations would be drawing upon that. And then you also don't know whether bookkeepers were unscrupulous, whether they really were robbing them. A lot of money had to go into trust for the government. Aboriginal people hardly ever saw that money. It was put into savings accounts. They were not told how to access their money. They had to ask permission from a chief protector or a government man to spend their money. A woman would say, I'd like a beautiful white dress, you know, the latest fashion, and there'd be this scoffing letter back saying, what's the point of this woman having a white dress? It would get dirty and she doesn't need such an expensive dress. There was an Aboriginal man who had worked very hard for many years, got paid very well, obviously services were highly valued, wanted to buy a motor car in the 1920s. And the chief protector said, no, we can't have Aboriginal people driving motor cars. So clearly thrift was encouraged and they weren't really supposed to spend their money, but then this was used by the government as a way of keeping them in their place.
From my own personal experience in the early 60s, working with a group of four or five Aboriginal men, we drove a mob of cattle from a place called Willaroo into Katherine, which is about 80-100 kilometres or 100 miles from Katherine, 3 or 4 days. Got to a point outside of Katherine where the manager came out, picked me up from the team, gave me £5, I think it was, gave those men £5, and they were experienced ringers. I was a jackaroo. And when they got to town, he told them to go to one of the shops and they'd get a new pair of trousers and a shirt and a hat, and then that'd be it. That's the wages. Now, they got the same wages as me for men who were experienced and people that I admired. So there was very little monetary remuneration for these people. There was no accommodation costs, there was no severance pay, there was no looking after their accommodation in town. They were expected to find, you know, a place to camp, bring their swag and their family, move off the property basically for that wet season, maybe a 4 to 6 months period, and look after themselves. There were no social security entitlements. So if they didn't have family, they had to basically find another job somewhere if that was possible, or fish and hunt in the vicinity of where they were dumped to get sustenance or be looked after by someone else.
Pat Dodson. And the living conditions?
Well, you'd have the ringer's quarters, if you're lucky. That's a room where you put your swag on a bunk with a mosquito net. You'd have a communal mess up at the big house. You go up there for your feeds. But if you're an Aboriginal person, you may or may not be allowed up into the big house. Your accommodation would be something that you'd be able to scavenge from around the station dump, a few bits of tin or iron or... people used to flatten out some of those old square kerosene tins and make them into walls, or an old tank of some type that you'd fashion into a bit of a windbreak. Accommodation varied tremendously, but basically they were tin huts, very little ventilation, dirt floors. There were no ablution blocks attached to them. There may have been an ablution block in the area, if you're lucky. Otherwise, down the creek for a bogey. toilet. There might have been a toilet with a couple of 44-gallon drums sunk into the ground. But everything was a very dry sort of part of the place you're living on, rocky and stony. No protection from the insects or the mosquitoes or the flies or dogs. Or your fire was outside. It would be a wooden fire. And if you didn't have a hut, then you'd just be camped out in the flap in your swag with a bit of a windbreak, maybe a couple of tins or jerry cans or something like that to break the wind from blowing on you in the night and the dust. So you'd be exposed to all the elements.
Pat Dodson, and still living rough in the 1960s. So if pastoral workers had been doing it hard for a long time, when do the unions, who were to run the case in 1965, first come into this story? Anne McGrath.
Well, that's interesting, because in the 1920s, the North Australian Workers' Union very actively fought against Aboriginal people being allowed into the union. They boycotted hotels even and stopped drinking beer because they wanted to stop Aboriginal people being employed in hotels. But they put up a very big case to argue that they should get paid higher wages because they had to supervise Aboriginal people and that Aboriginal people not be put in their award at all. So that's the 1920s. And yet by the 30s, I think you've got more radicalism because of the Depression and because of these well-politicised white men teaching Aboriginal people about their rights and human rights and how that pastoralists were making all this money and that the Aboriginal people weren't getting any. So their thinking started to change. But there were other issues too on Wave Hill. If you look at what Vincent Lingiari told Frank Hardy, he was very upset about the number of Aboriginal women that had been taken out of the Aboriginal community by white men. And they felt that white men monopolised the women. They even arranged the work of the Aboriginal men so that the Aboriginal men would always be in stock camps a long way from the station so they could have the company of their women and that their own husbands could hardly get to see them. So they were very angry about issues which I would see as to do with kin reciprocity and the whole running of the social system, as well as the wage issue. But in Western society, the wage issue was something everybody could understand.
But I think you have to take into account that in 1965, the Northern Territory government chose to virtually give Aboriginals so-called equal rights. Okay, they had equal rights, but there were awards that were in force in the Northern Territory, such as the Pastoral Industry Award, where Aboriginals weren't entitled to equal wages. So the Rights Council pursued the North Australian Workers' Union quite persistently and insisted and demanded that they do something about the Pastoral Industry Award. Now, this eventually happened after some pressures, I think, from the ACTU, because we were lobbying all around the place for some justice, wage justice for Aborigines.
I was going to say, what was the initial attitude of the AWU? Because it wouldn't have had, for example, many Aboriginal members, would it?
They had virtually no members. In fact, this was one of the problems of the organisation. There were probably more Aboriginal workers in the pastoral industry than there were white workers in the Northern Territory. And I think they were reluctant to bring them into the union movement because they saw them as a group that would not necessarily be able to be canvassed by the union. They were spread so far across the territory. The union didn't have the resources to look after these people because there were, I think there was over nearly 400 stations in the Northern Territory. If they visited one a day, they wouldn't get round them all in a year. And the union, I think at the time, the leadership of the union was worried that with mail going to those stations that perhaps the managers of the stations might influence their workers as to how to vote. So there are lots of reasons, I think, why the union of the day was reluctant to move in and service those people.
Was it also difficult for the union to proselytise, to campaign for Aboriginal workers to receive full pay when they weren't, in fact, under their coverage?
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think, in fact, that was one of the outs that the secretary of the day used. You know, well, they're not members. But from time to time, we had got Aboriginals work at equal wages. For example, I'd got 17 full-blood Aboriginals work on the Darwin waterfront. They joined the union, paid their dues, and they were good workers and were real happy to be receiving the same wages as white workers.
Here in the vast outback, 600 miles south of Darwin, I listen to allegations of deprivation and inhumanity, of Aborigine claims that on some stations they live like dogs in huts they have to crawl into. Their food, salt beef and damper. Aboriginal leader Dexter Daniels wants wage equality now, not, as the court said, by December 1968.
Well, it's a long time to wait. I think we shouldn't wait. We want the money now.
You want the money now?
Yes, by 1968. Too long to wait.
So you want to break the law, in effect?
That's right.
You think you get all the Aborigines on your side?
Yes.
In all the Northern Territory?
That's right. I will. I'll do all I can. Every ways I can. I'll bring them in my ways.
Aboriginal Stockman's leader, Dexter Daniels, interviewed there by Frank Bennett for Four Corners in 1966, demanding a speedy payment of the award. But wages were only part of the story, as the Wave Hill strike in August 1966, led by Vincent Lingiari, showed the Gurindji people were also determined to sit down in their own country and stay there, regardless of the outcome.
Gurindji were working, nothing but rations. Once they had gathered the wealth of the land, Vincent said, we're not talking about wages. We're sitting right here till we get our land.
Land was and is an equally important part of the story. And with that in mind, now to the equal wages case itself. We've already heard from Hal Wotton, who during a distinguished legal career became president of the Native Title Tribunal in 1994. But back in 1965, he was junior counsel to John Kerr as advocate for the pastoralists in that case against the union. Privately, he felt that Aboriginal workers were entitled to equal wages.
I guess I felt, well, you know, I wish I'd been on the other side in this brief, but it became quite obvious that the unions who were bringing the case weren't going to brief a barrister, so that was never going to be an option for me, and I thought it certainly would be a very interesting case, an opportunity to learn something about Aborigines in Northern Territory.
Some of them get about 10 quid every month, every 2 months. And most of these stockmen's got children. And like to put the children in the better schooling and housing. And they got to support their wives and children. Because we want the children to be a better education. So they can do better when they grow up.
Buffalo hunter and film actor in Jeddah, Tudor Wally, speaking there on behalf of the Northern Territory stockmen. For lawyer Hal Wotton, the biggest problem when it came to the Conciliation and Arbitration Commission hearings in 1965 was that those voices weren't heard in court.
You know, it seems to me that the great default was on the part of the Commonwealth, which should have said, look, we can't just deal with this question of wages in isolation. We've got to deal with it as part of the question of the whole future of Aborigines. The first thing we've got to do is talk to them.
Junior Counsel Hal Wotton. The Commission's report summed up Aboriginal work performance as they saw it.
It was put to us that these Aborigines on the cattle stations are unable to work as well as whites because of cultural and tribal factors. In the first place, they are, in the employer's submission, semi-tribalised, and even in the union's submission, they are not fully part of the white community. It was put to us by witness after witness that there are a number of factors which prevent most Aborigines from working in the same way as white men.
Well, you get some of these jackaroos that don't know how to muster cattle. They don't even know how to ride a horse. They make you laugh.
The reason why Aborigines in their tribal state had no real concept of work is due to a number of factors. They had no idea of forward planning, of working out a long-term enterprise based on predictions of future planned occurrences. Their culture excluded the idea of discipline, reliable and responsible endeavour under a contract of employment. When whites began to set up the cattle stations in the Northern Territory, The Aborigines remained on their lands, now taken over by the stations, and instead of hunting as a means of obtaining food, they substituted the obtaining of rations from the station owner in return for doing a little work. The effort, which the Aborigine used to put into hunting for food, was now put into working for food. And just as the hunter did no more than was necessary to obtain sufficient food, so also did the Aboriginal employee on the station do no more than was necessary to obtain sufficient rations.
The pastoralists wished to present a case that, firstly, that there were good reasons in terms of work value, why it wasn't feasible to pay most of the people on the stations equal pay. The pastoralists said that there were 20 to 25% of Aborigines they were happy to pay equal pay to, but there were a lot of people who either could only do a limited range of tasks or required very constant supervision, and it was only feasible to employ them at lower rates of pay. They were suggesting two other levels, a 70% and a 50% for the 75 to 80% who didn't, in their view, qualify for the equal pay.
Disemployment. The pastoralists argued that the application of award rates to Aborigines on cattle stations will cause massive disemployment. They submitted that for economic reasons they could not afford to employ Aborigines on award rates. The employers concede that some Aborigines are almost as good as whites and that Aborigines enjoy working on cattle stations because it is closely related to their earlier nomadic life and it keeps them living in their own country. But if Aborigines are to be paid the same as whites, then employers would prefer to employ whites because they could employ far fewer with the same results. We accept the employers' evidence that many of them expect to change over to white labour if Aborigines are to be paid at award rates.
There was no contact with Aborigines from anybody in the case, the union advocate, the judges or anybody. They were completely outside. They weren't parties to the case. They weren't witnesses. It was all white fellows arguing about them and what ought to happen to them. I mean, you know, in today's language, it was the greatest denial of self-determination that one could imagine. But, of course, people felt they were being very liberal and applying universal principles which must benefit Aborigines. All events to which Aborigines had to submit, whether it benefited them or not.
Well, you could have fooled me. It's just the same. He'd been in the same position as a man in jail. He'd be content because he'd got no, he can't do anything else.
Arguing the workers' case, Northern Australian Workers' Union Secretary, Paddy Carroll.
He's shown his discontent. He's getting somewhere. Because he's got parties getting together to try and solve the problem. Now, while he's content, he'll get nothing solved.
Well, it's often said that the Aborigine is not a very productive worker. He's inherently slow and can't accept much responsibility.
No, none at all. If I was getting £2 a week, I'd do very little. If I was getting a full award rate, I'd do what I'm entitled to there, what I'm supposed to do then, if I get proper treatment. But how do you expect a man to get £2 a week going to knuckle inside another man that's getting a full award rate? He's not going to develop any incentive to work and better himself. So this is all I'm going to get, £2 a week. Why should I worry about it?
Well, I think there's a whole story there in terms of the union's handling of that. They were arguing the award and they didn't call any Aboriginal people to give first-hand accounts or information. And so the two views, I suppose, you can take about the Arbitration and Conciliation Commission is that they were either influenced by the pastoralist argument that Aborigines had a cultural impediment and therefore shouldn't be paid the award wages just yet, and that some were slow workers and some were better workers, and that the white fellas really knew how to make those judgments. So the Conciliation Commission seemed to have accepted that argument. And secondly, it seemed to accept the argument of the government that this is a period of assimilation and that Aborigines really are a dying race and they're going to have to be assimilated into the white world, and that those that weren't up to a work ethic ought to be sent to the missions so that the missionaries could do their job on civilising and acculturating them to Western values and systems, and those that could work would obviously stay on the properties and be acculturated through the work ethic and in that way transit into the mainstream society.
From the wealth of material presented to us by pastoralists, both in oral and written evidence, we conclude that at least a significant proportion of the Aborigines employed on cattle stations in the Northern Territory is retarded by tribal and cultural reasons from appreciating in full the concept of work. The great majority are unable to work in a way which employers would expect of white employees.
Their argument was that Aboriginals were basically just hose holders. They weren't competent workers. In fact, that's the sort of arguments that they mounted in the case. The union's case was very ill-prepared. The union called no witnesses. On the other hand, the pastoralists did. They called a great wing of witnesses. I think as a consequence of the poor case that the union mounted, John Moore, the commissioner at the time, before he was Sir John and president of the commission, he chose to hand down a decision in their favour, but to be implemented in 3 years' time.
Now, to make this case, it was necessary to call evidence about what actually happened, what work was done. Indeed, my first introduction to the preparation of the case was to visit a very large number of stations and talk to the managers and to see what I could of what was going on. I didn't talk to Aborigines. My job was to prepare the case for the pastoralists. I would have probably been perhaps embarrassed to go and talk to Aborigines for fear that it might have been suggested that the employer's council talking to them was trying to influence them. Through this process, I met a lot of the pastoralists and took statements from them, from which ultimately we would select the witnesses who would give evidence. But as part of the pastoral case, we called a considerable number of people from the stations, and we had a number of inspections of work being done. And my most abiding memory of the case, whenever I think of it, the scene that comes to my mind is the scene on a station with some Aborigines demonstrating some work in stockyards. And on one side, the whole of the Aboriginal community, silent, uncommunicative, not making a sound. And on the other side, all the white fellas in the case, the union representatives, the judges, the Commonwealth representatives, the pastoralists, and absolutely no interaction or communication between the two groups. And in particular, I remember Sir Richard Kirby, who was the president of the commission, one of the most genial and sociable people you could imagine, wonderful at communication, putting people at their ease. He would be introduced to some of the Aborigines, shake their hands, smile, make some nice pleasantry, but be absolutely defeated in attempting any communication. And that was how the whole case went, with employers, pastoralists producing evidence. There was very little, if any, cross-examination of the pastoralists by the union, because the union was saying, none of this matters, it's just a matter of principle, everybody has to have equal pay.
Conclusion. We agree with the pastoralists that there are many Aborigines on cattle stations who, for cultural reasons and through lack of education, are unable to perform work in a way normally required in our economic society. We agree that the problem of assimilating or integrating these Aborigines into our society is a difficult one with many facets. Our task, however, is a limited one. The guiding principle must be to apply to Aborigines the standards which the Commission applies to all others, unless there are overwhelming reasons why this should not be done. The pastoralists have openly and sincerely explained their problems and future intentions. However, they have not discharged the heavy burden of persuading us that we should depart from standards and principles which have been part of the Australian arbitration system since its inception. We do not flinch from the results of this decision, which we consider is the only proper one to be made at this point in Australia's history. There must be one industrial law, similarly applied to all Australians, Aboriginal or not.
That would have given the pastoralists time to prepare for changes, which they did implement over the next couple of years, which basically was to move Aboriginals off their properties or away from the station, sometimes maybe 10 miles or so away into what eventually became Needs Claims, where the Aboriginal families resided, and the pastoralists invariably then just went into those camps and handpicked the few Aboriginal workers that they might need.
Well, I'm afraid that we're now realising, and this is part of efficiency, of course, that the Aboriginal is not as important and not as essential to the pastoral industry up here as we have in the past believed. And this is going to be the pattern.
Peter Morris, pastoral manager for the London-based pastoral company, Vestes.
We had a look at figures on this after discussions with a range of something like 40 different stations. And we think that any increase, for instance, this increase which is coming in the 1st of November, is going to mean a certain amount of disemployment. When we go to a further increase, which will be in 1st of December 1967, this in turn will lead to probably a little more. And finally, when the award wage comes on and the native is in direct competition with the white man for employment, then you're going to see in excess of 50% almost immediately.
Now, what this effectively did was to throw back the onus of looking after Aboriginals back onto the Northern Territory government. Up to that point, I think the pastoralists were happy enough to allow Aboriginals to live near their stations and to give them some measure of support and care, allow them to buy their goods at the station store, and in the event of illness or sickness, you know, call up the flying doctor, or, you know, develop a relationship with welfare patrol officers. But it was highly unsatisfactory for Aboriginal people, and the Rights Council had many complaints about ill treatment by various station managers in terms of the hours of work they had to work and the sort of conditions that they were working under.
This is the pre-equal wages situation you're talking about here.
That's right.
Because the picture I've often heard pastoralists state is, oh, we looked after them, we cared for them, we killed bullocks, we looked after them. How do you respond to those statements?
It's true, they did. And in fact, I think the station's attitudes varied, depended, I think, on the attitude of the people on them. I met some people on stations who had a really good relationship. They weren't necessarily the managers, the owners of the stations. A lot of them were managers, paid managers, and I spoke with quite a few of them when I did a survey in 1967, and I found there was a lot of compassion there, particularly amongst the women who really were concerned. That, you know, you can't generalise about it, I guess, because on some of the big properties where they had managers, they were real animals. I came across quite a few that were hostile to any suggestion that the union should get involved.
The whole case was conducted on every side, including the pastoralists, that assimilation was the inevitable, proper and only future for Aborigines. The judgment started by quoting the Commonwealth's definition of assimilation, and everybody assumed that was what was needed, and indeed the judgment of the Commission says what now appears very harsh in retrospect, that if their decision did result in Aboriginal communities being removed from the stations and put in the towns, well, that would only assist the process of assimilation. It would make education more accessible and so on.
Was there any room for a dialogue, in your memory of it, between these warnings by the pastoralists about the likely outcomes? Was there any probing of this, for example, against the union case for the obvious justice of the situation?
Well, certainly the judgment of the Commission tries to weigh it up. Neither the Commonwealth nor the unions really tried to come to grips with it. Indeed, if one reads the judgment, one can detect a bit of irritation on the part of the Commission that the Commonwealth and the unions were not facing up to the issues that the pastoralists were raising. And indeed, by and large, the Commission accepted all that the pastoralists said.
In our view, the criticism of the evidence produced by the pastoralists is no more than minimal. Generally speaking, we accept the uncontradicted evidence given by the pastoralists as to the workability of the Aborigines, supported as it was by what we saw ourselves and by the anthropological and other material. Although the idea of incentive, through money rewards, seems to be having some effect on Aborigines, we cannot agree that the introduction immediately of award wages could either at once or speedily break down all other influences at work in the Aborigines. In some cases, additional money would act as an incentive to better work, but in most cases, we have grave doubts whether the work effort would be appreciably different for some time to come.
I think there was probably a tendency on the part of the unions and the Commonwealth to take the attitude, all this is just what you'd expect the pastoralists to say, it's all being said in self-interest, they don't really care about Aborigines or what happens to them, and, we've got to listen to all this, but we don't have to take it seriously or deal with it. I felt that this was basically a very wrong and a very embarrassing situation. On the other hand, I thought that, the case we were producing for the pastoralists at least has the merit that it's drawing attention to the facts and to what's likely to happen. The Commonwealth and the unions played down the predictions of the pastoralists about what was likely to happen, and the Commonwealth said that was their responsibility anyway. But in fact, the Commonwealth did very, very little about it. And in the end, absolutely nobody challenged the evidence of the pastoralists about the work value. It was barely challenged in cross-examination and was not challenged by any other witness. And the court adopted it. But the court also adopted the position that, as a matter of principle, an arbitral tribunal couldn't make an award with different rates of pay in the same job.
If any problems of native welfare, whether employees or their dependents, arise as a result of this decision, the Commonwealth Government has made clear its intention to deal with them. This is not why we have come to our conclusion, but it means we know that any welfare problems which arise will be dealt with by those most competent to deal with them.
The great tragedy of the case is that by the application of this principle that was felt to be important to whitefellas' consciences, Aboriginal communities were just suddenly removed from their traditional land. Their whole way of life was destroyed. They were thrown into artificial settlements, often mixed up with people who might have been their traditional enemies, certainly not people they were used to living with. There was enormous disruption of Aboriginal society as a result.
Hal Wharton, junior counsel for the pastoralist case in the 1965 Equal Wages hearing. You've been listening to And In This Land We Pay the Price. Next week, we'll follow up the Equal Wages Award of 1966 and its social consequences for pastoral workers and pastoralists alike. And we'll take a special look at the Kimberley, where equal wages came late, but the results hit hard.
There was worrying for the country, to come back to country.
That's Worrying for Country, in Hindsight next week, the second program in this series, It's Not the Money, It's the Land, the Equal Wage Decision of 1966. Commission readings today, Murray Dassett, and studio production, David LeMay. I'm Bill Bunbury. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and pod.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.